I'd like to begin a discussion over the next few moments concerning the modalities of prayer, what prayer means to us in the Western world, how we were taught to pray, and how our prayers work within our bodies physiologically, and ask the question as to whether or not there could be other modalities of prayer that perhaps we've known about in the past and were lost for one reason or another, and what would it mean if we were to recover those modalities, and could we apply them in our lives today? When we speak about prayer, what I know and I've learned from audiences over the last 18 years all over the world is that the word prayer means something very, very different to everyone. It's a very personal concept, and everyone has their own idea of how to pray and how they were taught to pray and what it means in their lives. So I'd like to begin this part of our program by simply saying there are no incorrect ways of praying. Every modality of prayer is valid. Every modality of prayer has its place. Every modality of prayer has its purpose. And among all of the different ways that we were taught to pray, there's a very good possibility that there are other ways of praying that are not commonly understood in the West. And as we can understand those and develop them in their lives, they become one more tool in our toolbox of prayers. And the opportunity then exists for us to apply an even greater number of prayers in our lives, in the lives of our children, our families, and our loved ones, as we understand what they do and how they work. So when we talk about prayer, my first question is, how do we pray? How do we pray in the West? When I was a young man, I began understanding that prayer, there are many, many different modalities of prayer. And Western prayer researchers have lumped the many and varied kinds of prayer into essentially four categories that I can share with you today. And this is one classification system. There may very well be other classification systems that we can look at differently. In this classification system, we're looking at four modes of prayer that Western science identifies today. They are colloquial prayers, ritual prayers, petitionary prayers, and meditative prayers. And I'd like to describe briefly just what each of those prayers means, or what I am intending when I use those terms, so that we're very clear on precisely where we're going with this material. Colloquial prayers are the informal kinds of prayers where we speak to God or the creative forces or the powers that be in our own words in moments when we feel we need it the most. I had a friend, for example, when I lived on the West Coast, who worked the night shift, and more than once or twice a month, my friend would share with me that coming home in the wee hours of the morning on the 680 freeway in the Bay Area, the little dial on the gas gauge would begin to drop dangerously low, and my friend would say a prayer, "Dear God, this one time, if you will please just let me get to the Texaco station at the next exit, I promise I will never let my gas tank get this low again." And then I'd hear about the same prayer again a week later. But this is an example of an informal or a colloquial kind of prayer. A ritualistic prayer. And I'm amazed at how many audiences I speak with in the West are surprised when they see this word describing a prayer in the West, because they do not typically think of our prayers as ritualistic. They think of ritual as something that ancient or native or indigenous or aboriginal peoples are doing. Our lives are full of rituals, and our prayers are certainly no exception. So a ritualistic prayer is the kind of prayer that we use when we say a very specific set or form of words at a very specific time of day, at a very specific time of year. For example, at the evening meal, when we sit down with our families, "God is great, God is good, let us thank Him for our food." That is a ritualistic prayer. "Now I lay me down to sleep. I pray the Lord my soul to keep," saying those at bedtime, night after night after night. Those are rituals. So these are examples of ritualistic kinds of prayers. Petitionary kinds of prayers are prayers where we literally petition the powers that be for the good in our lives. There are teachings from around the turn of the century, late 1800s, early 1900s, where the force of God is identified as the I Am force, mighty I Am. In this moment, I claim abundance now and in all past, present, and future manifestations. This is an example of a petition to God for abundance in our lives. I claim the right to heal and to be healed now in all past, present, future manifestations. So these are just simple examples of what a petitionary prayer might look like. Meditative prayer, and this is very controversial because for some people in some schools of thought, prayer and meditation cannot be used in the same sentence. They are so very, very different on the one hand. And on the other hand, there are overlapping similarities in very specific modalities. Certain kinds of prayer and meditation are so similar, it appears to be simply a matter of languaging and semantics. Meditative prayer, generally there are no words. In the meditation, we simply become aware of the presence that permeates the world around us and of us as being a part of that presence and part of all that we see. So while these definitions are certainly subject and open to interpretation and revision, I'm just sharing with you briefly and generally to give you some idea of what the four modalities of prayer are like that are typically acknowledged in the Western world today. Colloquial, ritual, petitionary, meditative prayer. Now, the reason that I'm sharing this with you is in the last two decades in my journey, my search to understand who we are and how we relate to the forces of this world and referencing the wisdom and the knowledge of those who have come before us to lay the foundation for those kinds of understandings, something very interesting has happened to me. What I've found is that on the temple walls on Egypt and Bolivia, in some respects Peru, in the ancient texts, the time-worn texts of the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Coptic libraries in Egypt, indigenous, the oral traditions that have been passed down for hundreds of years, generation to generation, they've always referenced a mode of prayer that simply does not fit into any of these four categories. It is none of them. While it may have elements of maybe one or another, it does not fit into those categories. And to describe this mode of prayer, what I'd like to do is share with you a story. And I think perhaps by sharing the story will, again, lay the foundation that we can draw from to begin describing what now is recognized as a lost modality, or the fifth mode of prayer. It was in the early 1990s, in the American Desert Southwest. I was spending a lot of time in the Southwest exploring in the Pueblos, in the ancient archaeological sites, Chaco Canyon, New Mexico, for example, Bandelier National Park, the traditions of those who have come before us in our own backyard. It's so interesting to me that so many people believe we've got to go halfway around the world to find some of the most amazing sites that this planet has to offer. And the reality is that in our own backyard in North America, we have massive, massive, intricate sites that were constructed by ancient peoples a long, long time ago. And one of the reasons it's so interesting to me is because anywhere else in the world you go and you see archaeological sites on the scale that we see here in North America, such as Chaco Canyon, they are called temples, temple sites. Here in our country, when we see something like this, and if it's not of this time, they're called old Indian ruins. Old Indian ruins. And there's a thinking that goes with that, and I find that very interesting. It was in my exploration of the ancient temple sites here in North America that I met a man who became a good friend of mine, and it is through my relationship with this friend that I can share with you what this lost modality of prayer is like and specifically how it works. So in the American Desert Southwest in the early 90s, there was a time of tremendous drought. The rains had not come for almost 5 years, and it was one of the driest periods that any of the elders could remember. The land was so dry that the Rio Grande River that actually begins in southern Colorado had all but dried up through southern Colorado into northern New Mexico. It actually began near the village of Cuesta, New Mexico, with the confluence of the Red River. That is where the Rio Grande actually began. I had a phone call from my friend one day, and I'll call him David, just to honor his privacy. And he said, "Greg, would you like to join me tomorrow morning when I go to a place in this world where my ancestors have gone for so long, no one can even remember why they began going here in the first place? It's a place," he said, "where the skins between the world become very thin. And in that place, it becomes very easy for a man or a woman in this world to communicate with other worlds." And he says, "Would you like to join me as we go to this place and pray rain for the crops and for the villages in this part of the world. And he didn't have to ask me twice. I said, certainly, I would be honored and I would love to go. And I did. I met him the next morning. We found ourselves early in the morning, and this was in the summer months, hiking through waist-high fields of the beautiful, very fragrant, high mountain sage that you find in the arid deserts in northern New Mexico. It's so fascinating that as we walk through the sage, each time our legs would brush against the tender tips of the sage, they release this fragrance, and all of a sudden, everywhere we go, we smell the fragrance of fresh sage, and it's just a beautiful experience. And we found ourselves in a field, approximately 135,000 acres of this beautiful sage, and I was simply following my friend David. I had no idea where we were going. And suddenly he looked and he says, well, there it is. And I looked, and I wasn't sure what I was looking at. And he says, it's right there. And as I looked across the sage, I could just barely make out a place where the landscape looked a little different, that the tops of the sage were a little uneven, and we followed a path that led over to that place, and there in front of us was a very ancient structure on the ground, essentially an ancient medicine wheel that had been placed there a long, long time ago. And I asked David, I said, who put this here? And he said, this wheel has been here for so long, our ancestors don't even know who placed these stones here. And when I heard him say that, I remember I was just in awe, because I realized that the stones that I was looking at on the ground were precisely where the hands of another individual had placed them generations and generations ago. And David said, this is the place where the skins between the worlds are very thin, and this is the place where I'll pray rain. Well, I'll share with you right now that I was not prepared for what I saw. I had an expectation of what I thought was going to happen. I believed that I was going to see some chanting, at the very least, some dancing. And what I saw took me by surprise. David removed his shoes, he stepped into the wheel, and the first thing he did was he honored all of his ancestors. He said, all of my ancestors who have come before me, all of my ancestors. Then he honored the four directions of the four elements. He turned his back to me, held his hands in a prayer position, raised his face into the sun. And just a couple of moments, he turned around, he looked at me, and he looked at his watch, and he said, I'm hungry. Should we go get a bite to eat? And I looked at him, and I said, I thought we came here so that you could pray for rain. And this is where the crux of this story is really key. Because he looked at me, he looked right into my eyes, and he said, no, we did not come here to pray for rain. He said, because if we prayed for rain, the rain could never happen. And I said, well, what do you mean by that? He said, in the traditions of our people, when you ask for something to happen, what you're doing is acknowledging to the Creator, to the Great Spirit, that it is not so, that it has not yet happened. So if I came and asked for rain, I would be saying, in effect, that there is no rain, and actually reinforcing the very condition that we came here to change. And I said, I understand that. When I saw you turn your back to me and you close your eyes, then can you share with me what happened inside of you? I asked him precisely the same question that I've asked the Tibetans, that I've asked in the nunneries and the monasteries, that I've asked in the Egyptian monks and the Peruvian shaman. I asked him, I said, describe to me, if you can, what happened inside of you. And he said, certainly. He said, when I close my eyes, I'm not praying for anything. He says, I'm feeling the feeling of rain. So when I close my eyes, I feel the feeling of what it feels like to stand in my village with my feet naked in the mud. And the mud is so thick, it's oozing up between my toes because there's been that much rain. And he said, I engage my senses. I smell the smell of what the rain smells like when it rolls off the earthen walls of the homes in our village. And I feel the feeling of what it feels like to run naked through chest-high stands of corn. The corn is so high because there's been so much rain. And he said, in that way, I'm calling to the rain. And in that way, I am praying my prayer. We put our things back into our bag, headed back into the road. David went to his home, I went to my home. That evening, the most interesting thing happened. Over the Sangre de Cristo Mountains to the east, big black clouds came in just before sunset. It was a sight that was welcome and had not been seen for many, many weeks. Before the sun went down that day, it began to rain. And it rained and rained and rained and rained. And by early the next morning, the rain had been so plentiful and the ground had been so dry that it could not absorb it fast enough. And there was actually flooding in low-lying areas. And I called my friend David and I said, David, what in the world is this all about? What's happening here? And David was silent on the other end of the phone. And he said to me, well, that's the part of the prayer I haven't figured out yet. He said, well, we can ask and feel the feeling of the rain. He said, but I have not figured out how to know how much to bring. Now, I have to say, as a scientist, there is no way for me to say that the prayer that David offered that afternoon had anything to do whatsoever with the rain that came that evening. As a scientist, I have to say that. I also have to acknowledge the correlation. The correlation was so high. There had not been any rain for so long. And the rain that came that day was so localized. It was fascinating. On the weather maps, I was pulling in the station from northern Colorado, from the Denver-Boulder area. And I remember the weatherman looking at the graphics on the weather map, and he saw the jet stream coming from California across Nevada and Utah, just as it always does this time of year. And then when it got to the Front Range, to the Denver-Boulder area, the jet stream did a big dip right down into northern New Mexico, did a tight U-turn, and went right back up into Colorado and on across to the Midwestern states. And I remember the weatherman, he looked at that and he stood back and he held his hands up to his chin in contemplation and he said, huh. And that was all he said. It was a very anomalous weather pattern. So I have to say that at the very least, the correlation between the time of the prayer and the pattern of rain exists. And when we put this within the context of what the ancient peoples tell us about their relationship to the forces of nature, including weather, what it means in their lives, it begins to make more sense. So what happened? What happened in David's example of the rain? Well, earlier in this program, we began describing the field of energy that permeates all of creation, the field of energy that links everything together, that's been with us from the time of the very beginning, the field of energy that has an intelligence that responds to human emotion. And from our understandings of this field of energy, what we could say in very real terms, through laboratory and experimental evidence and anecdotal evidence as well, is that what we become in our beliefs is what we experience as our world. What we become in our beliefs, not what we think, what we become in the beliefs of our heart, what we feel, is what we experience in our world. And this is precisely the understanding that so many of the native peoples have regarding this modality of prayer. What David did was he felt the feeling as if the rain had already occurred. And if you recall our time with our meeting at the Tibetan Holy Man in 1998 and again in 2001, when I asked the Holy Man a very simple question through the translator. I said, when we see you and the monks and the nuns, when we see your chanting and the tones that you make, the ohms and the mudras and the mantras and the bells, the bowls, the gongs, the chimes, when we see your prayers for 14, 16, 18 hours a day in the chanting halls on the outside, what happens to you on the inside? And the Holy Man said to me, you've never seen our prayers because a prayer cannot be seen. He said, you've witnessed the things that we do to create the feelings in our bodies, and the feeling is the prayer. And now David is telling me precisely the same thing. He did not ask for rain. When we find ourselves in a situation in our world, whether it's on a personal level or with families or friends or on a global level, and we feel helpless, powerless in a situation, and we fall to our knees and we ask for intervention, we ask for help from a force that we believe is outside of ourselves, that kind of a prayer is called a prayer of supplication, where we are feeling that there's nothing that we can do and we need some help. Those prayers are good. They have their place. They're certainly valid. And what David was sharing with me is that there is a modality of prayer that is not a prayer of supplication. He says, we're part of all that we see. I remember as we looked across the 135,000 acres of the desert sage And in my mind's eye, it looked to me like there were many, many, many plants of sage that were growing in that field. And David and I had this conversation, and he said, you know, to us, on the surface, they look like separate plants. But he said the sage are very interesting in that they grow as families. And he said even though they look like separate plants on top of the ground, they are actually linked through a common root system beneath, and that we may in fact be looking at a very small number of families of sage represented by many, many individuals. Well, that unity that he was describing, he said that we are a part of all that we see. We're part of that sage. The sage is all a part of one another. In the kind of prayer that David was describing to me, we are a part of all that we see. We are a part of nature. We're a part of our world. So from David's perspective, rather than asking for an outside intervention to help create rain, David was essentially saying, I'm part of this world. I'm part of all that I see. If I'd like to change it, I have the language to intervene on the behalf of our world, and the language is a nonverbal language. It's the language of coherent emotion. He felt the feelings of what it would feel like to create that rain in his life. Now, this is so interesting because from this perspective, when we go in to so many of the Native American complexes, in the kivas, the underground, the circular underground structures where many of the prayers and rituals and ceremonies and teachings have occurred, or we go into the pueblos above the ground, we see that they actually surround themselves with the images of the things they would choose to experience in their world. They surround themselves with images of wildlife to remind themselves of the feeling of what it feels like to have abundant food and abundant raw materials for clothing. They surround themselves with images of crops, paintings of corn and of wheat, so that they can surround themselves with the feeling of what it feels like to have this kind of abundance in their food, in their lives. It leads us to ask the question, what do we surround ourselves with? If the things in the world around us are reminders of the kinds of things that we choose to experience in our lives, what does it mean for us to live in a world of entertainment that's based in violence, in killing, in war? What does it mean for us to live in a world where our sports that is so violent has become a form of entertainment? What are we surrounding ourselves with, perhaps on an unconscious level, on the one hand? And if this relationship in fact works the way these principles suggest, are we really surprised that when we surround ourselves with violence and entertainment, that violence comes back to us in our world in ways and at times that perhaps that we don't expect, as random shootings, as wars and tension between nations, as a global buildup of nuclear weapons, as random school shootings and the drive-bys that we see in almost every major city and the gang activity that we see today? We'll explore this, and I'm planting the seed now, because David's prayer gives us insight into understanding perhaps why the events of our world are unfolding the way that they are. So the implications of what David's prayer are saying to us beautifully exemplify and illustrate this lost modality of prayer, this fifth mode of prayer. In the language of their time, ancient traditions left us this very empowering message for us and for the people of our future, if we have the wisdom to recognize what they said. And the instructions are so precise. The instructions are so clear if we recognize how these principles work in our lives. So what I'd like to do is share with you, from the perspective of the Dead Sea Scrolls, the exact instructions as they were left to us to implement this lost modality of prayer, what it means in our lives, and then go through and work with these instructions in a way that allows us to implement them into our personal and our family and our community lives today. From the Essene Gospel of Peace, Book 3, we are invited to consider that we live in this world from three different perspectives. So I'm going to begin the quote and then I'll elaborate on what this quote means. Three are the dwellings of the sons and daughters of man. This is the first part of the quote. It says that we live in this world in three ways, three different ways of perception. Although they are separate, they are related. Three are the dwellings of the sons and daughters of man, and here they are. These are thought, feeling, and body. Thought, feeling, and body. This is right off a 2,200-year-old text. It's saying that you and I experience what we experience in this world through our thoughts, through our feelings, and through our body or our emotions. Emotions are held in the body. So body and emotion, from this perspective, are almost interchangeable. Thought, feeling, and body. So we're experiencing, we're perceiving in this world in these three different ways, and now we're going to have the precise instructions in terms of what we do with those perceptions. And this is the quote. When these three become as one, you will say to the mountain, mountain, move, and the mountain will move. I'm going to say that one more time. When these three become as one, when the thought, feeling, and emotion of our lives are merged into a single potent force, then you will say to the mountain, mountain, move, and the mountain will move. I've got to say to you, in my years in the corporations, as a scientist, as an engineer, when I first began reading this particular quote, perhaps it's no accident that I came across it so early on in my studies, I originally believed that this was a metaphor. That when the text invites us to say the mountain move, the mountain will move. And through what I have seen in my time in the indigenous peoples and in many of the ancient cultures and villages, what I have read and what I've seen with my own eyes, I now know that this is not a metaphor, that this is a literal description of the power that lives within each of you, the power that lives within every one of us. When we can marry what we call our thoughts and emotions into the kinds of feelings that are called coherent feelings based in our hearts, there's a direct measurable effect in the world around us. Western science now is beginning to explain and describe why this happens. It's because thought, feeling, and emotion, though they are three separate, they are very related experiences, and we marry them together, we create the nonverbal language that speaks to the mind of God through what we call our beliefs. Our beliefs are the language that speak to the mind of God. We'll continue with more in the next session. So the text suggests that thought, feeling, and emotion, three are the dwellings of the sons and daughters of man. Thought, feeling, and emotion are the principles that allow us to interact with the world around us. And what I'd like to do is just take this time and define the differences between thought, feeling, and emotion. What I mean when I'm sharing those words in this program, how they work together, how they work separately, and how they may be merged into the single potent force. I'm on the road, traveling quite a bit, and I try to talk to my mom. I try to give her a call about once a week. Generally, it's a long-distance call from somewhere in the world. And Mom and I have had many discussions late into the evening about precisely this topic, thought, feeling, and emotion. Mom says to me, I always thought feeling and emotion were essentially the same thing. And her sentiments, I've found, are echoed throughout much of the Western world, that we find very little distinction sometimes between feeling and emotion. We kind of lump them into a category and say, there's something that's there. So what I'd like to do, in your mind's eye, and in the drawing that is in your CD workbook, if you can envision an image And I've included an ancient image from the Hindu traditions of the energy centers of the human body, the chakra systems. In the 8 chakra system, the lower 3 energy centers are associated by the ancients with what we call the power of emotion. The power of emotion. Emotion, it's the force that lives within our lives that tears down the walls and breaks down the barriers that stand between us and the things that we choose to have in our lives, the things that we love and hold dear. And what the ancients say is that the power of emotion needs to be guided. It needs direction in and of itself. Emotion is scattered. If you know people that live in their emotions, live in their emotional body, or perhaps you in the past have lived in your emotional body, you know that life can be a little chaotic and a little confusing. Living purely and reacting and responding to the events and the challenges of life simply through emotions. However, when the emotions are given direction, that is the way that we focus our emotions. So the emotions are associated with the lower energy centers of the body. And from the perspective of the ancients, they say that we are capable of essentially 2 primary emotions, and that's it. They say that we are capable of essentially 2 emotions that we today would call love, and then whatever we believe the opposite of love is the other end of the spectrum. So perhaps we would call the 2 primary emotions love and hate, or maybe love and fear. And to be very honest with you, because I know many tremendous scholars have done a lot of work with this material, so I'm choosing to be very clear, when we get really, really deep into the esoteric traditions, even love and hate, or love and fear, are essentially one and the same force. They're one and the same. For the purposes of what we're doing here, I'm going to suggest, through the traditions of the ancients, and I'm going to be specific here, the ancient Essenes and many indigenous traditions, emotion, there are 2 primary emotions that we're capable of, love or hate. Without something to give our love or hate direction, this is where our lives can become very chaotic and very scattered. And this is where the experience of human thought becomes very important. Thought is associated with the upper energy centers, the throat center, the communication center, the third eye, the pineal center, and the crown chakra, the crown center. Thought, in and of itself, has very, very little power. I'm going to say this one more time because it's perhaps a little different than what some of the teachings of the esoteric traditions in the past may have suggested. Thought, in and of itself, has very little power. It is a directional system. When we think about something, our thought is simply an image, perhaps associated with imagination, and it is only when we fuel our thought with the power of human emotion, when we pump the emotion of love for what we're thinking or hate for what we're thinking into that thought, that we empower that thought. And when we do so, by definition, we create what is called a feeling. So by definition now, feeling is the union of thought and emotion. Feeling is the union of something that we're thinking about, or you can use the word imagination, fueled by our emotion, the love or the hate or the charge for whatever it is that that thought entails. And by definition, when we marry the two together, we create what we call now a human feeling. So if you're having a feeling, what it says to you is, although you may or may not be aware of it, that you're thinking about something and you're having an emotion about that thought. If you don't like the word thought and emotion, you can think of thought as imagination, and as emotion, as a charge. When we have a thought without emotion, it's simply a wish. I remember back in my years working as an engineer, I used to be part of a carpool. And this was after the oil embargoes of the 70s and into the early 80s. Trying to save gas and cut down on pollution in the city I was living. It was Denver, Colorado at the time. And when it was my turn, every once in a while, I'd get to the house of the gentleman that was my turn to pick up, and I'd arrive a few moments early and maybe use his kitchen for a glass of water or maybe use the bathroom before we'd go back out into the freeway. And this was a time when affirmations were really coming into vogue. Affirmations are the words that we speak many, many times, day after day after day, in an effort to essentially create a belief in our bodies that will help some desired effect or outcome occur in our lives. For example, the affirmations, I am abundant now, I am abundant now, I'm abundant now. I know people that used to say, I am abundant now, a bajillion times every day, and for some people it worked, for some it didn't. And if your affirmations have not worked for you, what I'm about to share with you may offer a clue as to the reason why. So I'd pick my friend up for the carpool, maybe I'd go use his bathroom, and all over the mirror were little post-it notes. My perfect mate is manifesting for me now. My perfect mate is manifesting for me now. I'd go into the kitchen, and little yellow sticky tabs were on the kitchen counter, and they were hanging from the cabinets. Of course, we'd go out into his car. They were all over the dashboard in the rearview mirror, and I spent time with him at work, so I already knew that they covered his CRT, and they were all over his desk. My perfect mate is manifesting for me now. My perfect mate is manifesting for me now. And I asked him one day, I said, how does this affirmation work for you? And he looked at me, and he said, you know, it doesn't. And I said, why do you think that is? He said, I don't know, but he said, I sure hope it works soon, because if it doesn't, I'm never going to have anybody in my life. And by sharing that with me, what he was actually doing was sharing with me the true feeling of what he felt was true in his life and revealed the power of a thought without the emotion to accompany it. And this is what I mean. If we simply say the words, my perfect mate is manifesting for me now, my perfect mate is manifesting for me now, bajillion times a day, it is an empty thought. It's an imagination, or we would call a wish. And the only way to empower that thought or that wish is to fuel it, imbue it with emotion. Now, there were some of you that asked me this morning, Greg, are you going to lead us through a guided meditation, or are you going to teach us a prayer? And I said, no, and now I'm going to explain the reason why. I think guided meditations are really good, and I think they've served us really well. And you've had a million of them. How many times can I ask you to take a deep breath, sit by a flowing brook in a grassy field, and feel good about what's happening? It works, and it's a tool, and it's powerful, and for some people it works better than others. But here's what's happening. All the studies that are showing the power of prayer, what happens is people do their prayer and then they stop and they get up and leave because the prayer is something they do and they want to change their world rather than something they become in their world. How many of you feel different now than you did when you came into this room this morning? People said, is this an experiential workshop? You have had an experience today. And you did it through your logic and your heart combined, because we moved back and forth. We never had a guided meditation. Well, as the ancients suggested, there are two possible emotions that we can use. Our love of what it's like to think about our perfect mate manifesting for me now, or the hate or the fear of what that experience might bring into our lives. So my friend, for example, through our conversations, what I found from him was that while he was thinking the thoughts of having someone to share his life with on the one hand, on the other hand, what he really felt was essentially, who in the world would ever want to spend their lives with somebody like me? I work long hours. I don't have much of a social life. He's saying, who would want to spend their lives with someone like me? And in doing so, he was actually sabotaging, unconsciously, he was sabotaging this affirmation. So I shared just this little story. It was just a simple example. If your affirmations have worked for you, then obviously you know on some level why you're doing what you're doing. If they have not worked, however, you may consider the story from my friend in the carpool. Because if your thought is not matching the emotion, or the emotion you're pumping into that thought does not empower that thought, then your affirmation may simply be a wish. The quantum hologram, it reflects what we have become in our lives. There's a subtle and important difference between what we do and what we become. In our outward expression of life, we can do things that appear one way, What this teaching is saying, and what the ancients are saying, and what quantum physics now is suggesting, is while what we do is important, what we become inside while we're doing it is really important. So another way of looking at this, here is the quantum hologram, our non-physical world of possibilities. Every possibility you could ever imagine, all the healing and peace you could ever imagine in your world, it's already here. As well as all the suffering and the illness, it's already here. It's a blueprint. What the teachings are saying, what quantum physics is suggesting, is that there's something we do in our lives that speaks to this blueprint. There is a language that awakens specific blueprints and crystallizes them through vibration into what we know as the events of our world. They have meaning in our lives. So there is a language here. Our non-physical, unseen world of possibility and our physical world of experience. What is the link? We're now beginning to understand through science, the ancients told us in their way, the link is human emotion. Emotion is the link. Emotion awakens the blueprint and produces the effect that we see in our world. We must feel the feelings in our bodies of what we choose to experience in our world. Feel the feelings in our bodies of what we choose to experience. Not what we don't want to experience. Creation apparently doesn't understand the word don't. So if you say, don't think of a pink elephant, creation, what have you got? I mean, you're immediately thinking of a pink elephant. It's all done in the affirmative, in the positive. What we feel, what we become in the unseen realms. Remember, this is the realm where the four forces of nature merge into one potent power. This is the realm where emotion speaks to that power. So through the power of human emotion, coherent, heart-based emotions, we are speaking the language to these forces here, and we're seeing the effects in the world around us. The language of their time, ancient traditions left this very empowering message to the people of their future. And now we're trying to understand the language of our time. We began with this great mystery. The mystery looks like this. Something we do in our lives triggers a process in our bodies that interacts with the forces of creation and affects our physical world. When it does, we call it miracles. That language says heart-based feeling and emotion changes the chemistry of our bodies. Scientists know this. Producing quantum effects that affect our physical world. And it's done through the quantum hologram. It's the same thing. So heart-based feeling and emotion changes the chemistry of our bodies, producing effects that extend beyond our bodies. The effects are not limited to our physical bodies. And it's done through the quantum hologram. They left us very precise instructions in terms of how we do this. These are right out of the Dead Sea Scrolls from the Essenes. They say that we live in this world in three ways. Three are the dwellings of the sons and daughters of man. Thought, feeling, and body. So we interpret, we live in our world through thought, through feeling, and body. And it's with thought, feeling, and body. When these three become one, you will say to the mountain, move, and the mountain will move. Does that have a new meaning now? That is so clear. A 2,500-year-old text. What an amazing thing to be able to say. So from this perspective, thought, feeling, and emotion associated with the energy centers of our bodies. The emotion is the power source that must be given direction. Thought gives it direction and creates what's called a feeling. Feeling is associated then with the one energy center remaining in our body that has not been accounted for. The human heart. The human heart. And I think that's so interesting. In the Western world today, the number one cause of death in adults in the Western world today is heart disease. And this also may help to explain perhaps why that is. In our hearts, our hearts are the place where we reconcile what is happening between our emotions and our thoughts. In our emotions that we carry in the lower energy centers of our bodies, in our emotions, we have the experience of what we sense is true for us personally in our lives, the way we choose to live our lives, the values that are important to us in our lives. On the one hand, in the upper energy centers, we have the thoughts of what the world around us, what our society, what our communities, what our civilization, what our family says to us must be true. And in our heart centers, we must reconcile. This is where the battle occurs. This is where the tension happens. In our hearts, we've got to reconcile what we sense is true for us personally with what the world around us says must be so. Our feelings are the result of that reconciliation. So bless our hearts as we have the opportunity to reconcile all that we know about our world with what we feel in our bodies. At the same time, our feelings then become the beliefs, and the beliefs are the language, the programs of consciousness, literally the language that speaks to the mind of God. We can try a little example of this before we move into the next section and actually begin applying it. What I'll invite you to do, what's so fascinating, this literally is an internal technology, thought, feeling, and emotion, three separate yet related experiences occurring within our bodies. What's so interesting about this is we can have the same thought, imbue that thought with different emotions, and create very different feelings, and in doing so, change the chemistry within our bodies and influence on the quantum level the world around our bodies, and all we did was change an emotion. The ability to be able to do something like this at will, on command, is the beginning of a very, very powerful internal technology. And it's this technology that we'll share in the next sections that allow us to bring healing into our bodies and peace into our worlds with very little effort once we understand how the principles work in our lives. Before we get to that, let's just work with this concept through one quick example. What if we have the thought of war? I remember I was touring the world as the United States was considering going to war with Iraq in 2003. I was in Australia at the time, and I had the opportunity to have the input and the feedback from people all around me and how they felt. I'd just been in Canada before that. How the people felt about what was happening. And it was so interesting because they all had the same thought. They were all thinking war with Iraq. So I'll invite you just to think about the thought of war. Now, the emotion, if we hate war, so if we pump the emotion of hate into the thought of war, we find ourselves feeling feelings that might be described perhaps as feelings of anger. If you feel anger when you watch the 6 o'clock news, when you see the very graphic wartime footage, and you wonder why you're feeling so angry, I'll invite you to consider this little formula and work with this as you watch the same kinds of footage later on based on what we are discussing right now. If you think the thoughts of war and you're feeling anger in your heart, there's a good chance that your emotion is something akin to hate or possibly fear of what that war brings about. However, if you think the thoughts of war, and even in the presence of war, you can have loving feelings about life in general. Not love for the war, simply loving feelings about life in general, you will create very, very different kinds of feeling. Mother Teresa, before her death, was a living master demonstrating precisely this concept. There are stories that Mother Teresa, she would walk down the streets of Calcutta, and amidst the bodies and the filth and the stench and the decay on the streets and the sidewalks and the alleys, she would find cow dung in the gutter, and in the cow dung find a lily or a daisy growing from that cow dung, and in that lily or that daisy, she would find beauty in the streets of Calcutta. And from that example, we learn how we can find beauty or we can find love anywhere, in any situation, regardless of what's happening in our world today. Through our example, if you think the same thought of war, and rather than hating the war, just simply feeling the love in your heart for this world, for your life, for this planet, what happens is the feeling, rather than being one of anger, becomes one of perhaps compassion or maybe sadness. Different words that describe the feeling for different people. But war and love give us a very different feeling than war and hate, compassion and sadness. So from this perspective, within each of us, we are given the internal technology, thought, feeling, and emotion, three separate yet related experiences that allow us to create the conditions inside of our bodies that interact with the forces of the world around us, the four fundamental forces of nature. Through thought, feeling, and emotion, you and I have the ability to touch those forces and to interact with them in ways we're only beginning to understand. So from the perspective of the instructions left to us by Isaiah and the ancients and the Dead Sea Scrolls, we're reminded that through the power of thought, feeling, and emotion in our bodies, we have the ability to massage the language that we radiate to the world around us, the power to interact, to participate in the events of our lives in ways that are perhaps unexpected and surprising to many. In the language of the West today, the words, the English words that best describe the quality of feeling that we would most like to have in our hearts, the English words that best describe the kind of feeling that optimizes the chemistry in our bodies, the peace of the world around us, are the words appreciation and gratitude. Appreciation and gratitude. These are the key. As David explained to us through his prayer of rain, we must become in our lives, in our hearts, in our beliefs, the very things that we choose to experience in our world. As we hold the thoughts for the healing of our loved ones, or the healing of our bodies, or the success of our careers, or the abundance of our lives, the peace of our world, as we hold that thought in our love for those things, feel for us what are the feelings of appreciation and gratitude. In that way, we are speaking the language of the mind of God, the language of the quantum hologram that has the direct measurable effects on the world around us. 500 years before the time of Jesus, a man walked the earth and shared his message with us, describing precisely this internal technology. His name was Buddha. What was Buddha's message? If you could encapsulate his message in one, two, three words, what words would describe the quality that Buddha invited us to bring into our lives? Well, words like compassion, gratitude, and love. What Buddha said to us in the language of his time, he didn't try to explain why our world works the way it works. He simply said to us, if you live your lives the way that I am sharing with you now, you'll change your body. And when you change your body, you'll change the world. 500 years after the time of Buddha, another man walked the earth, and his name was Jesus. And Jesus had a very similar message. It was a message of compassion, forgiveness, gratitude, and love. Jesus said to us in the language of his time, he said, live your lives the way that I am describing, as I am sharing with you now, and your lives will change. And he said, when your lives change, the world will change. And Jesus took it one step further. He said, here, I'll show you. He said, and I'm paraphrasing, he said, world, give me the worst that you can give me, and I will show you that even your worst I will transcend by the choice I make in my life. And I believe that is the value, that's the power of the message that was left to us through men, great teachers such as Buddha, such as Jesus. Everything that we've shared in this section, in theory, everything that we have shared in concept is contained in the most cherished traditions of our oldest spiritual understandings. Not the words, the quantum hologram in the mind of God, rather the principles that describe to us and remind us that within each of us lives a power that makes us not separate from the world around us, that promises that we are part of the world around us, and with that promise, we are given the power to participate, to choose in the kind of lives that we would like for ourselves, for our families, to choose in the kind of peace that we would like to have in our world. Let me ask you a question. If you understood that you could directly access the fundamental forces that are responsible for the building of our universe, what would that mean to you? How differently would you live your life? The way that we implement these choices now is the subject of the next section.